This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Welcome all our listeners in the U.S. and around the world. You're listening to Baseball Outside the Box. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo, and this is the show that interviews baseball's best coaching minds who love to challenge the status quo. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode. We just have planned our 2019. We had our first show a week ago, and now we're bringing you the second show. We are kicking off some great stuff this year, so follow us. First of all, don't forget, Caliendo Sports International, this summer in July, August, we'll be traveling with players all different ages, Japan, Cuba, Dominican Republic, Italy, and also in softball. If you'd like to be part of that program, please email me and I'll get you all the details. Also, the schedule's getting tight, but if you'd love to have me come out and speak to your group, whether it's players, coaches, or parents, please do so. Again, you can email me at petercaliendo@att.net. Next week, I will be off to Italy with our World Baseball Softball Coaches Confederation Technical Tournament Committee meetings, along with doing a two-day coaches program in Italian for a local club. So we're going to also be doing a podcast from there. So check that out. We're going to do one in English and then do one specifically in Italian for the Italians so they can also learn from the podcast. Don't forget, do us a favor, spread the word on social media. Because of you, we are getting a lot of people listening to the podcast, and it just keeps getting better and better. So I want to thank all our loyal listeners and welcome all our current listeners. All right. As you know, the last show, we were at the ABC Baseball Coaches Convention, and we had a great time. There were over 6,500 coaches who attended from all over the U.S. and the world. And during that time, which was very unique, I want to thank our guests in a minute here. The place is chaotic. There's things going on everywhere. And there's a lot of learning going on. And during that time, our guest was walking and happened to walk past me. I don't know how he noticed me, but he did. And he actually took the time to stop and introduce himself. And you know what? I've heard of him. I've seen him on social media. He's got some great things going on. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him in a minute and then welcome to the show. But I just thought that was first class what he did just by, you know, stopping and saying hi and visiting a little bit. So let me tell you about our guest, Sean Larkin. First of all, you can check him out on Twitter, SLarkin04. Great stuff that he has on Twitter. So follow him and we'll put all this stuff on the show notes. So you'll have all the details. Now, Sean has a history of background as far as baseball is concerned. He played in high school and college. He's coached at some really top level schools in collegiate baseball. You'll see that on the show notes. You can check it out. He was drafted by the Cleveland Indians. He coached for the Indians in a minor league system. And now he has an incredible job. I think a lot of people would love to have his job. He is a skill development coordinator for the Los Angeles Dodgers. And that is an incredible position. So we're going to talk to him about baseball development and also practice organization. And so what I'd like for you to do right now, I want to welcome Sean Larkin to the show. Sean, how you doing, buddy?
Oh, man. Thank you for having me on the show, Peter. Extremely honored and a pleasure. Great meeting you, like you said, last weekend. And all the stuff that you do, not only in the United States, but across the world is truly inspiring. And to be a part of this conversation with you is really exciting for me.
Well, Sean, I appreciate that. And I'll tell you what I see, and I've been thinking about this, I see now in baseball, I really love it. And I know some guys, you know, sometimes they're, you know, we're all set in our ways. And, you know, sometimes baseball doesn't like changes. But, you know, when I grew up, I started at Mickey Owen Baseball School at 15, you know, the way we taught was how we were taught. So we kind of did, you know, we followed the leader. Whoever taught us, we taught it that way. 15 years ago, I started thinking different. But, you know, what I love about the ABCA and about baseball now is, and you're included in this. I know you may feel old, but you're not. I think you're 38. At, you know, 38 years old, I see a lot of young people really challenging the status quo out there. You see more and more in professional baseball, college baseball, and it's great to see that because it revives all of us. It gets us all thinking, you know, there's always better ways to do things. And, you know, I think that just grows the game a lot better.
That, you know, that's so true. And I like the word you used just now was better. It's not, sometimes we fall in the trap of saying things are good and bad. I think if we're trying to search for better, it keeps our minds open. And like you said, now more than any time ever in the history of baseball and coaching, the ideas are really flowing. A lot more openness to change and exploring different ways to, whether it's teaching mechanic or mechanics in general, or just the idea of environment creation and how to reach our players better to maximize, you know, at the margins, the best we possibly can. And with the use of social media and these big giant conventions that are happening and podcasts, I think we're really seeing a trend shift to being open is a way to go. That's the better way, at least being open to new creative ideas from no matter your age or experience. That's what we're starting to see a lot of in our game, especially is that this new and old are great, creating new ideas and people are listening, and it creates incredible conversations, which sparks more thoughts and more ideas and more creativity. So it's this beautiful cycle that's happening in our sport right now. It's really fun to be a part of.
Absolutely. And folks out there, you know, if you're not growing, you're going to be left behind. So, you know, do us a favor. The reason we want to educate everybody, we're all growing together. We're growing on this podcast as I listen to Sean talk. You know, and I want to send a message before we start, Sean, a little bit to our friends all over social media. Most people are pretty good. You know, they call it social media, but sometimes it's not so social because, you know, they get into a heated battle. And I just want to send a quick message to all our friends. You know, look, we're all in this together. You don't have to criticize people. If you disagree, well, then, you know, explain why you disagree. Show some science behind it. Maybe some research and development. Talk about it, because you never know. You might change your mind, you know, with, that somebody might have something a little bit better than you have right now. What do you think, Sean?
That's exactly right. I can't say that any better than you just did. And, you know, a lot of the stuff I follow a lot of people that I may not necessarily agree with. So I think anytime you're searching out information and, or you go to a conference or you're trolling on the threads, it's, you know, are you finding stuff that one agrees with what you're already thinking, so you're not really growing, or is it, it's okay to be challenging your thought process. And if you can look at it through the other lens and why are they seeing it that way? If we remember that no one's wrong. You know, they're saying what they're saying for a reason, that, which means that somewhere along the lines, it worked. So somewhere it was right. And that's why they're talking about what they're talking about. So if we're able to ask appropriate questions and how they are able to come up with their conclusions, and again, whether we agree with the process or not is one thing, but at least being open to other opinions and ideas, just like we want people to be open to ours, we got to be on the other side of it as well, open, at least open to it, to listen to the discussion. And sometimes you just agree to disagree, and that's okay, and that's what makes us all better. So when we're looking at this information, it's either strengthening our current beliefs because it's been supported by somebody else, or it's challenged us to think a different way, which is always great, or maybe it just convinces us that what we believe is what we're going to stay with, and that's okay too. But going out to try and prove someone's wrong, I think we're just doing a disservice for everybody who's tracking it and following.
Absolutely. And, you know, I didn't mean, well, actually I did. I did want to bring up your age. You know, I know you don't want it public probably. Notice I didn't bring up my age. I brought up yours, but I did that for a reason. And that's because, you know, today's game is changing and we've got a lot of young people at higher levels. And I think that's great because, you know, there's a lot of open minds. And I just want coaches out there that are young coaches to understand that, you know, when I grew up, you weren't seeing young guys in professional baseball, and you weren't seeing guys that were not, that didn't play professionally based, you know, professional baseball somewhere in the system coaching. But now you're seeing that. And I love seeing that part. So I just want to let coaches out there know that there's some great opportunities if you really put in the time and work hard and smart at it.
Now is the time, especially with the access that a lot of decision makers have to you, just in terms of they're able to find what you're putting out there. They're able to find your research. They're able to find what you're writing. And that's who's getting the jobs now. Now, it's one thing to put it out there, but you have to support it once you're hired. But now is the time. I mean, I think in our player development staff, our coordinator group, our, you know, the leaders of our organization, I think there's only two over the age of 40. Which is a lot to be said of how this game changed, like you said. So our leadership group, 99% of us are under the age of 40, and then our coaching staffs fall right in that line. Now, there's a mix of older people, which is great, and they have a balance. But the point being, there is no age on impact. There's no age on being able to be relevant in our sport. And the old age adage of you have to put your time in is kind of gone. It's who can help us right now, regardless of your age and quote-unquote experience. What value do you bring? And if you do, whether you're just out of college or you're 75, people are looking to add value to the organizations regardless.
All right. Listen, one thing I want to ask you right away before we get started is, you went through the Cleveland system as a coach, manager, and you're now with the Dodgers. Throughout the time you were with Cleveland and the Dodgers, from the beginning till now, what's one area that you changed in your, and you may have changed several, but what is one critical area that you changed in your coaching style or development style from the beginning when you started till now?
I really, really took a, when I first started, it was about telling everyone what I know. And now, especially to this day, today, right now, it's my style is more about more involvement with the player. How engaged can I keep the individual player or group of players involved with the process of their own development? It's no longer about what design can I make for them based on what I think. The real shift has been, how many questions can I ask my players to get them to come to their own conclusions? And honestly, really makes me better. I've learned more from my players the past couple of years than I probably have taught them just by conversations. And that's really the shift in my personal growth as a coach, is really realizing how important it is to partner with the player, because ultimately it is their career. And from there, if I know what their motivations and what their aspirations are and what they're trying to dig into or how they're perceiving something, it allows me to dig deeper and to create the environments that best suit them. And then we have a conversation about that again. And that's what's really been driving my coaching style and had reaping the benefits from it with our players, is involving the player more in the complete interaction of a developmental process.
You know what? I love the part that you said about asking questions. And I remember, and there's, I've learned from many coaches. Then also I believe that, you be creative and you learn as you go. One thing that I did learn on my own, which, about probably 10, 12 years ago, was to ask a lot of questions and instead of talking all the time. Now, here's what I want to ask you. I want you to give our audience an example of a player coming up to you, or you working with a player, the question you ask and the process.
Right. Okay. So I work a lot with the infielders. My hands are with the infielders a lot. So a very typical question from an infielder is, what should I have done there? Maybe it's a slow roller or a backhand play or forehand, but what should I have done there? My initial, instead of answering, hey, you should have come and got that played one hand, it's, what do you think you should have done? How did you perceive the ball? Because remember, I'm looking at the ball's bouncing away from me and it's bouncing towards you. It's two different perceptions. So to ask me what you should have done, it really doesn't matter what I have. I don't know. So I don't know a lot. What do you think? How do you think you could have made that play easier on yourself? What did you do? What other tools in your toolbox could you have had to make that play? What do you think? What did that make? How did you feel making the play the way you did? You tell me. And that drives the question. So that's an example of how questions I use questions. I basically answer them with a question and make them answer them to me. And then we can drive the next particular drill set or round of balls based on that. And then again, it's like, okay, how did that feel? What was different there? Was it easier? Was it harder? More comfortable, etc. And again, it's more of almost me sounding like the player traditionally asking the player, like the coach, like, what do you think? Uh-huh. And that's kind of the example of how I can work the process on that.
Sean, you're doing this at the professional level. So hopefully we're reaching a lot of people and they're starting to do it with young kids, because young kids, obviously, this would work fantastically.
Absolutely.
Where did you come up? Where did you learn this? When did you start using this process with your players?
Yeah, so I do a lot of reading. I do a lot of research. So the more books I've read on just culture or business books on just leadership and all that, that concept came up often. And what it did was it gave me a sense of awareness of what I was doing. And then as I would go out into the field and I would come off of reading these things and I would be out there coaching, I would catch myself talking a lot. I would catch myself telling players what to do and cut them off when they're trying to explain something and try to impart how much I know, because that's what a young coach does. Like, here's what I know. Trust me, I should be here. So it was really just researching it, and it has kept hitting me in the face, you know, indirectly through what I was reading and watching other coaches. And then it created awareness, and I caught myself. I started catching myself doing it. And then I started noticing it when other coaches were doing it. And I was like, wow. And I would observe and watch how players would respond and how they would sometimes just shut down the more I would talk or more another coach. They would, you could see it in their face go like, I'm done hearing you talk. Yeah. And they'd shut down. And what you were saying wasn't landing anyways. But when I started asking questions, they were 100% involved and engaged in the conversation because everyone likes to talk, right? So that's when I really hit me the most, is just being aware and then actually watching it play out and kind of learning the hard way, having the feeling of this player is not listening to me right now. Why? And the more I became aware of it and then utilize a different strategy of communication and just involving the player more in the process. I mean, the environments and the drill sessions or whatever we were doing just became a lot more fruitful and productive. And the longevity of our relationship was just incredible.
Folks, last weekend, Sean Larkin spoke at the American Baseball Coaches Association. I encourage you, one, to go to abca.org, check it out, become a member. And also the DVD will be out. Definitely encourage you to get it. He spoke in front of 6,500 coaches. It was an incredible amount of people there with a lot of knowledge. Sean, you talked about developing skills and managing behaviors, and you mentioned behavior improves player development. Let's talk a little bit about behavior to our audience and explain what, you know, not your whole, obviously you can't go through your whole talk, but explain what the basis of your talk was.
Sure. You know, the real point was understand, if we don't understand human behavior and what drives and motivates an individual, how are we able to coach or get the most out of them? You know, a lot of it was driven on, you know, how punishments and reinforcers really work and understanding how to use them the appropriate way. Because if we don't, what's the point of using them? We talked about why an individual behaves the way they do. And there's four functions of why behaviors happen, whether it's to escape or avoid a situation, whether it's to gain access to something someone wants, whether it's to gain attention from somebody, are three of the major ones. And if you understand what or why an individual is behaving the way they are, what they want, it drives how you reinforce and punish their behaviors. And a lot of that goes into, which leads into environment creation, how we can create environments that are more motivating, more inspiring for our players and understanding their motivations. And if we're able to understand why individuals behave the way they do, and then understand what they respond best to in terms of communication or reinforcers or punishers, then we can create the environments that allows them to grow exponentially faster than if we didn't know, as instead of assuming that we know what players want or don't want. That is the crux of what I was talking about, just understanding how human behavior works and understanding why. That was what was driving force behind it. So we can get to the bottom of these things, the better off we're going to be. So like for an example, if you know, you have a player who doesn't show up on time for practice or who's consistently not running hard down the line, say, why are they doing that? Maybe they don't want to play in the game because there's a lot of scouts watching. They're nervous and they know if they don't run hard, they'll get taken out of the game. And a coach takes them out, well, because we think it's punishment. Well, really, we just reinforce that behavior. We basically said, if you don't want to play, and you want to escape the situation, just don't play hard and we'll take you out. So that may not be punishment to a player. It might be reinforcing their behavior. So that type of idea, right, is understanding what works for one may not work for another, is important. And I think something that you said too earlier about our coaching history and who we were coached by, you know, sometimes we think that if it worked for us, we think it's going to work for everybody. And that's just not the case. You know, if we were handled a certain way and we maybe you and I responded well to a coach who yelled and screamed because that's just what we respond to. So then we project that on the players that we coach, but maybe half the players that we coach don't respond to that type of feedback, the yelling and screaming and the punishment. And now we're not getting the most out of our players because we're only going to one way of doing something. So I know that's a lot, but like that's the crux of it. It's basically understanding how human behavior works and why we do what we do. Everyone behaves a certain way for a reason, and understanding those reasons and functions goes a long way into how we can drive our developing our skills through environment creation and maximizing what our players want through their own personal motivations.
Absolutely. And then just so you know, the second half, we're going to talk about environment creation, practice organization, design. We're going to talk about those things. But just to stay on this a little bit, you know, let's take a player. You know, a lot of coaches may run into this. Let's take a player for some reason now is lacking the hustle. Now, it could mean many different things. Let's take our coaches through that scenario, how you'd handle that.
Yeah, so for one, what we need to understand is that hustle or playing hard is pretty subjective. You know, what's hustle and playing hard to one may not be to another. So that's a really hard one. But we also need to understand some players just don't know what that means. And I'll give you a personal example. We had a player when I was managing who, you know, big power hitting first baseman who was from a small town, and his high school coach basically told him, go play first base, hit homers, and that's your job. And he was the best hitter around, and no one said boo. So his defensive work, he didn't really care. He didn't go about it. But he loved baseball. He loved playing. But he had never experienced having to work hard. So he was taking ground balls, and he was kind of going through the motions, lackadaisical, not really hustling, running down the line. And we had a conversation about it. Like, what drives you? It always said, I want to play in the big leagues. I want to be the best. And he just wasn't aware that he wasn't practicing and playing hard because he had never experienced it before, because his history of reinforcement, his previous coaches never said a word about it to him. So he always thought what he was doing was right. So understanding that, understanding where he's coming from and where his experience lay was driving his behavior. And we need to understand where players are coming from and what's been reinforced in the past to understand why they behave now. And that's kind of the example I like to use, because if I don't know that, I just punish him, take him out of the game, and he doesn't really know why or understand. And we just get stuck in the rut. So understanding why he was behaving that way was very important. And another end of this thing too is what, again, hustle. If a player's not playing hard, like, what's the context, right? Is it a high school kid or a junior high kid, wherever it is, playing for a travel league team, and they're at this major tournament with thousands of coaches there looking to recruit them? And this player, in his mind, here's his chance to shine. Here's his chance to get a scholarship. But oh, by the way, it's a 9 a.m. game, and he just played four games the day before, and he gets blown up his first at bat, may not run hard because maybe he's tired or just embarrassed or whatever it may be, and he's not playing hard, and all the coaches, they write him off and say, this guy's a dog, and we just place our value, like we place a judgment on him because we don't understand the context that's surrounding it. This kid is trying so hard, it actually goes the other way, and he's getting evaluated on it. So these things need to be kept in mind. You know, the context of what's going on, the history of this player, of what's been reinforced in the past to allow him to behave the way he's behaving now, really goes a long way with how you manage it in the current moment. If that makes sense. I know it's deep, but that's how now to this day, that's how I would handle a situation, making sure I understand all these working parts before I make a decision. So if I know if a player is not hustling, but I do know for a fact he wants to play, and taking him out of the game is going to be the most punishing thing to him, that's probably what I'll do. But remember, if we want a behavior to change, if we want him to hustle, we need to reinforce him hustling when he does. So just punishing the action we don't want only works in the moment. If we want long-term change, we have to make sure we're reinforcing what we want to happen. So when that player does hustle or he does play hard, we need to make sure we acknowledge it in the way that that player receives it the best. And it could be hey, good job. Just acknowledge it. Like, we have to reinforce it for it to keep happening.
Absolutely. And I thought that was really well said, because, you know, a lot of times we tend to always say the negatives and not enough positives. And, you know, what do you do? Let me ask you this. What do you do as personally to, you know, I know you read a lot of books. I know you go to conventions. You speak to a lot of people. You do a lot of research. So anything else that you recommend the coaches that they might do to make themselves better? Because, you know, a lot of times we can't hear ourselves or we don't know what we're doing. You know, we're actually doing it, but we're not really sure if we're doing it correctly. Is there anything you do to kind of self-correct yourself?
Again, I think anything we're doing, it goes back to the awareness piece. If we can just be aware and understand the concept of environments and what's being able to really observe what's happening. When I say something, what happens? When a behavior occurs, what's happening before that behavior? What happens after the behavior? Just being really, really aware of the context in the environment and being able to interpret what's happening, whether it's you yourself, whether how you're speaking, whether how you're acting as a coach. Are you the one that's throwing equipment and yelling at players when things aren't going right? And then you're upset with our players when things go awry for them. Like, you're modeling that behavior for your players. Mm-hmm. How aware are you yourself of your own thoughts and your own behaviors first? And then you can move on to the players or your other coaches. What is happening in the environment when a player behaves a certain way, whether it's good or bad? You know, is it only does a player throw his helmet only when the bases are loaded or a runner is in scoring position and he strikes out, like, because he wants it so bad for his team? Or is it every single time when it's a selfish act? Like, what happens before the behavior, and then what are we doing after it to either maintain or reinforce it? Again, it goes back to the awareness piece. And then, again, reading books, podcasts, conferences, and just being aware of really taking the time. And because it's hard. It's hard to self-evaluate. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes when we uncover stuff we don't like.
Right.
But that, if you want to get better, no matter what you're doing, you got to get uncomfortable. And sometimes dissecting yourself and like, wow, I this is how I behave, or this is how I respond, or this is how I treat my players, can go a long way into just getting you better at what you do.
Now, as coordinator of skill development for the Dodgers, you've got a huge responsibility. Give us an idea, because I assume that you have a lot of coaches under you. Give us an idea what your main responsibility is and how you organize that throughout the organization.
Yeah, so my main role as a coordinator of skill development is to oversee and implement and write the program for how we develop our players. So how we create our practice environments, how we use our drills, how we utilize our practice time, whether it's offensively in the cage or on the field, how we utilize the time on the field for infielders and what drills we're doing there, and when to push and when to pull. Really just an understanding and a framework for our development philosophy of how we develop our skills from AAA all the way down to the Dominican. That's what my hands are in.
Go ahead.
Yeah, that's the crux of it. I wrote an acronym and a practice philosophy on how we develop our players, and that's kind of resonated now through the system. And that was my main role. Like, that was my job to do. Like, how, look at how we practice and flip it on its head and make sure we're doing it the best or better way possible. And that's what my hands are in on a day-to-day basis, including running the infield program as an infield coordinator, and I got my hands in that, some mental skill stuff as well. So it's an all-encompassing role that's really, really cool that I was able to develop and design myself with the previous farm director, and it's carried over to be really, really cool and fulfilling. And I'm only as good as the staff that we have in our player development system, so I don't view it as anybody under me. I think we're all, like you said earlier, we're all in this thing together, and I'm only as good as my coaches. My coaches are only as good as we all are together. So that's what I do on a day-to-day basis. Again, my hands are in a lot of different things, but it revolves around our practice design, how we utilize it, blending research and then applied experience, and making sure we have a nice balance and we're not going too far one way or the other.
You know, and that leads perfectly into what we want to continue our talk in, and very important. I feel it might be the most important topic in baseball. I'm sure there's others that are very important, but when it comes to practice organization, because of the fact that, you know, we could lay out a practice, we can do it, and if it's not organized correctly and properly and doesn't have some reasons why you're doing it, then it doesn't translate into a real game, then we've kind of wasted our time. Mm-hmm. Now, what I noticed, you had on social media, which I thought was very interesting. You put a quote by Leonardo da Vinci, and the quote goes this way: "Those who fall in love with practice without science are like a sailor who enters a ship without a helm or a compass, and can never be certain whether he is going, wherever he is going. He's not sure." You put that down because what's guiding your practice, you ask, and are you tracking it? So what I want to do is let's jump right into what are some of the key elements of your practice design, you know, that you start with, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, I mean, I have my personal five that I think are all, like I said, all encompassing from research, from experience, and it's kind of whittle it down to, we can hammer if we can all five, but at some regard throughout the week or days or months, like if we can have one of these five different types of aspects of our practice design, I think we're doing okay. And number one, I think you can't get away from foundational principles. I think we can't get too far away from doing things that are foundationally there for a reason, whether it's a feeling, a mechanic, whether a wide base or wherever it may be. From our youngest players all the way to our major league players, you see have some sort of foundational base they go to. And they practice it. You know, Major League All-Stars have a certain tee drill or a flip drill or a ground ball progression or something to maintain or get back to a feel they want. And I don't think we can negate the fact that there's a time and a place for practicing the fundamentals and having a nice, solid foundational base. That's one aspect of it, right? So maybe some foundational principle time early in the practice. And then we got to move on, though, to at some point we have to have some sort of decision-making. Because that's what the game is. It's reading a situation, formulating a plan, and then actually doing the movement. So how do we allow our players to make decisions? Whether it's, you know, as a hitter, do we allow swing take decisions? Like why do our BP rounds revolve around number of swings? Like why can't we say, hey, this round is seven pitches, and if you take five of them, that's a good round if they're balls. Like practicing making decisions on balls and strikes, making decisions on, you know, maybe it's, are we allowing our base runners to make decisions on batted balls? You know, we yell at players for not going back in a line drive, but how often have you practiced it? Are you allowing time and practice for your players to see trajectory off a ball in relation to where players are positioned on the field to make those decisions? So gaining this perceptual awareness drives everything. Remember, perception drives movement, and then our movement affects our perception. So you can't take the individual out of the environment. It's an interacting part, ecological dynamics. You know, our movements are driven by our perception. So we have to be able to practice making decisions because that's what drives our movement patterns. So how can we implement that in our practice design, whatever that may be? So foundational principles into some decision-making, speed differential. Like how can we have some sort of speed change, whether it's, you know, a little bit more on the fastball machine or breaking balls, just changing speeds as hitters because that's what we see. Can we mix in, making sure we mix in different speed types in our ground balls? It's not just practicing two or three hoppers to infielders, like mixing these speeds up on purpose. I thought about this the other day. If we're doing like cuts and relays, speed differential on the base runner. Like what if we have a slow team and we don't have any fast runners? Why don't we start some runners about halfway between first and second and make our fielders like, hey, here's a fast runner, and we can actually simulate it. So some sort of speed differential in our practice design to get our guys attuned to the different speeds of the game. Mm-hmm. How about some sort of stressor or consequence? Hey, baseball is based on winning and losing. You know, there's a winner and a loser. You're out or you're safe. It's a ball or a strike. Like, there's consequences and stressors in a game. So how can we create that, whether it's through competitions, BP competitions, inter-squad games? What can we do to create some sort of stress and or consequence in our games that simulates a game environment? And now I'm not talking about stressor of like, hey, if you miss a ground ball, you have to run. Or that's practicing, that's coaching by fear, and that's a whole different conversation. I'm talking about just natural game consequences and stressors. And what this does, it also not only simulates the game, but it also gives you a chance as players to work some sort of mental skill that you may be talking about, whether it's a breathing technique or a visualization technique. It allows your players to actually start practicing some of these things you're trying to implement as well. And I think the final piece, and the one that you alluded to earlier, was some sort of a tracking or technology or feedback component to allow you to know where you were, where you are, and where you're trying to go. Like, how do you know what you're doing is working if you're not tracking it? Or you don't have some sort of technology, a sensor, or something to track progress? Or any sort of feedback, how do you know what you're doing is right without having some sort of tracking device? So again, foundational principles, some element of decision-making, speed differential, stressor or consequence, and some sort of tracking or feedback mechanism to let you know where you're at. And I think if you hammer as many of these as possible over the course of time, you will hit on a lot of the practice theory and philosophy research, and also keep it real in our own environment of baseball in the actual dirt that's relevant to what we're trying to do.
Sean, that's awesome. I'll tell you what, this was, I'm glad we brought this up because this is some great stuff. I think that coaches will benefit tremendously. I want to break down a couple of these. Let's hit the technology right away. I know you mentioned technology and utilizing it to track your practice organization. So give us an idea, whether it's Rapsodo, give us an idea how you would use one or two technology areas to help your practices.
I think technology is only as good as how you use it, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's pretty much out there now. And I think someone said at this conference recently is like, before the technology, it's like you have to understand how your players move in the first place. So having some sort of assessment of how your players move is going to be the most important. But if you do have some, like, say you are using a Rapsodo for your pitchers and or hitters, and we'll say hitters because that's the hot one, and you're trying to track exit velocity and how the spin's coming off the ball and launch angles and stuff, and you're trying to get to a certain window, which is fine because that's where the most production is. You know, you have a baseline, you test it out on your Rapsodo, you test it, and then you go through your drill packages, whatever that may be for you as a coach, wherever you think's the best to get to where you're trying to get to, and then you test it again with a Rapsodo. It's giving you feedback. It's letting you know where you're at now. So are the drills you're doing working? Are you still where you were 2 weeks ago, or are you moving ahead? Are your exit velocities going up or down? Is your launch angles getting to where you want them to be consistently enough or not? So subjectively, usually, like, you're just like, oh, yeah, you go in a cage and, like, you start blasting balls and the coach goes, wow, yeah, we're getting better. Well, what a technology piece would do, whether it's a bat sensor with a, you know, blast or a Rapsodo or a TrackMan, is going to tell you is, no, it's not getting better. Objectively speaking, the numbers aren't going to lie. Or it's telling you, yes, you are right. You are getting better because the numbers are kicking back now objectively. That's how we would use them in our settings. It's just a guide. Are we ready to move on to a more challenging type of drill sets? If we're dominating T and front toss drills and our numbers are showing up on these sensors the right way, maybe it's time to move on now to a more challenging environment. And then we test them there also, more game-like environment, because ultimately that's where it matters. Do our numbers line up in a competitive environment? That's all. Who cares if you hit the ball off a tee a certain way? Can you do it when the guy's winding up and throwing at you with runners in scoring position? So just having these ability to objectively track and chart what was really happening, I think is imperative. Or else, how do you know what you're doing, other than results in a game, which again are completely out of your control?
Absolutely, man. I remember many times, even as a player, you know, I'd be hitting off a tee, and you know, I'd hit the ball well, but you know, I really, you know, maybe the net was only 5 feet away, so I really didn't know where the ball was going. And I can see where these devices can really help you, because we think we're doing it well, but
absolutely,
the device may show something different. Now, our audience knows, because I've talked about it many times. I've been in the game 37 years, and I believe that, you know, one area we really fail in, and I think we need to do much better, and that is at the grassroots level. I think the sooner we get young kids, you know, when I look at these five principles you mentioned, especially decision making, when we get young kids making decisions in games or in practice, you know, by the time they get to you, they're going to be much better. You can go on to better things. And so I believe we need to start implementing this at the younger levels. Now, here's the question I have. Wherever you implement it, when you talk about decision making, speed differential, there's going to be failure. Okay. And, you know, initially, and sometimes players are going to struggle. I know I struggle with failure. How do you address that? When do you address it? And because, you know, otherwise, they're not going to believe in the process if they all of a sudden they start failing. An example would be if we didn't do batting practice the way everybody does it by throwing 50 miles an hour, that we now are changing, but now we're failing in batting practice. How do we deal with that?
Again, it goes back to the communication piece. I know the one thing I make sure I do in my particular role is educate the staff and educate the players on theories of what we're trying to do, and be upfront before they even start doing anything. Our practice designs are going to be built and designed for you to be challenged. And when you're challenged, you're going to fail. And remember, we're not evaluating practice performance. We're trying to improve your skill. So being upfront with these conversations and the expectation, setting the expectation up front that we expect you to fail. And almost if you're not failing or there's not some sort of ugliness to some of the practice plans, then we're not doing a very good job as a coaching staff in developing it. We're not challenging you enough. So I think the upfront conversation, regardless of the age, regardless of what you're trying to do, like, there's going to be times where we're going to fail. And again, that's what practice is for. It's an opportunity for us to explore as many things as possible for us as individuals. How am I going to individualize a method that I want to do for my body type and what works for me without failing in an environment where I'm not being – there's no score. There's no winner or loser. It's just an opportunity for me to stretch and grow and get better. And no matter what we do, there's going to be that process involved. So just the upfront conversation of it's going to be tough at times, and that's – it's okay. So that's – and again, that's a good point you make, because our game is built around – success and failure, punishers and reinforcers. Like, hey, if you get a hit or you hit it hard, you're good. If you're out, you're not good. If you make an error, you're bad. You make a play, you're good. Whatever it is. Like, as little kids, that's what they're taught. I have a two-year-old, and when he swings and hits a ball, naturally, as a dad, I go, yeah, there you go. And when he swings and misses, I'm like, okay, do it again. So, like, we as little guys, they're taught, like, one thing is good, the other is not. So if we got to untrain that thought process. And just understand there is going to be times where the players aren't going to really understand why, but it goes back to that conversation piece and asking the relevant questions. Like, why do you think we're doing this? Why do you think we're challenging you a little bit more? Why do you think we're making decisions in practice? You know, just trying to reframe the mindset as a job as a coach more than teaching a mechanic or a skill, I think is the most important part. And that's how you kind of can get over the initial hurdles, especially for the long term, is having that conversation, setting the expectation of what that player should expect from you as a coach in their practices.
You know, at the pro level, give us an example. And you gave a couple, but give us some more about, you know, some rewards or a system that you may use. You know, a lot of times we hear about quality at bats or, you know, things you might track, you know, something you use in your practices to show players they're getting better. Is there some type of system you use within the Dodger organization? Because if you use it, then obviously at the younger levels, they can definitely use it.
Yeah, I know. So we compete. We compete a lot. We set a lot of environments. We compete within our team, within our minor league teams. They compete within themselves in different types of competitions. And then we'll have organizational competitions where we'll pit our low A team against our double A team with various infield fielding, throwing competitions, hitting competitions. We'll have organizational, you know, decision-making competitions in-game, and we just track it. And as individual players, we'll just track, you know, how, especially in instructional environments and spring trainings, and even during the season, we'll sit down and track their throwing accuracy with a target practice, you know, and we'll chart it. Hey, 3 weeks ago, you were two out of 10. These past 2 weeks, you're between 7 and 9 out of 10. Like the mechanics or whatever we've been talking about, it's working and it's showing up. But a lot of our environment and with what we do with our professional players, it's always based on some sort of competition. And then we post it. We post the results and see where guys are. And again, it's not so much about here's the winner, here's the loser. It's like here's where you were in relation to the group potentially, and here's where you are now. Like, that's okay, because every individual is going to be different. Like, so it's more of a tracking against yourself as opposed to trying to win everything. But that's kind of how we do it. Again, we have every technological advancement possible in our system, so we can track every swing from where they were a month ago to now. It's heavily driven by analytics and by numbers, by sensors and TrackMans and stuff.
Sure, but if you don't have technologies, there's many ways to be creative.
Paper and pen is never going to go anywhere. It's easy to try. Hey, we're going to make 15 throws week one. And then we're going to set up some sort of target, whatever that may be. And then we work through the process. And then by week, you know, 8 or 10, how much better are you now? It's not that hard. It takes some creativity based on your resources and what you have available to you. But, I mean, we saw in that the presentation – By Tim Corbin at the ABC convention, they made an L screen out of luggage bags and metal poles. So, no matter what your environment is, you can be creative enough to get some sort of tracking or some sort of competition set up. I mean, we do that as little kids. We did that. Hey, that tree's first base, the sprinkler head second base. Like, you can be creative. Come on. There's no excuse not to create some sort of competition or some sort of game or some sort of tracking device. To demonstrate that where the progress is being laid.
Well, you know, one thing I learned going from USA Baseball, our national programs, to independent baseball, professional baseball, is that, we're all kids at hand and we all want to have fun. And this is creating a very fun atmosphere. Now, here's the thing. You mentioned each individual. Everybody's an individual. So now you've got particular players are tracking all this. Once you've tracked it and you see that they need to improve in a certain area, do the drills become different for every individual?
I would say they have to, right? I mean, so the one thing I've never really understood is why, if we have, let's say we have four groups of BP, right? There's three or four guys in a group. We have four groups. You can't possibly tell me that all four groups are going to benefit from the exact same BP. There's just no way, whether it's their mechanic that they're working on, whether it's their body types or whatever it may be, what they need to work on. There's no way it can always be the same. Or all your infielders. Do all your infielders need to be working on their backhands or shorthand or short hop drills? Like my young Latin players, they don't need to work on short hop progressions as much as our American players do. Their hands are so good.
That's right.
So it's just understanding like why wouldn't group one of BP work off the fastball machine? Because that's what this group needs. And oh, by the way, group two has a really they're having a really tough time hitting breaking balls, so they should be hitting breaking balls this round too. And then maybe my third group, they've been really struggling in general. They just need to feel good. Maybe us may have a regular BP day and let them just blast the ball all over the ballpark today, because that's what they need right now. The more I've dug into this, the more I'm really actually more baffled now than why are 12 guys doing the exact same thing for batting practice? Or why are 9 infielders doing the exact same drills? It doesn't make any sense if you think about it, right? And that's kind of a more more non-traditional thought process. Like, why can't I just change the machine settings for this group? Or why can't I move the L screen and ramp up a little bit closer for this group so I can throw a little bit harder to these guys? Why can't I mix pitches to this group, because they need to make more decisions? That's another way to look at it. And then that goes back to the individual need and whether it's an individual player or a group of players, depending on your resources and your time. But it doesn't make any sense, really, if you think about it, why everyone would be doing the exact same thing. Because we're always all working on something different potentially. And then given our body types and given what we can do physically, our mobility, our flexibility, can I even do the drill you're asking me to do? Mm-hmm. Can I even get my legs the right way? Are my hips locked up? And I can't even get in that position as a catcher. But you're asking me to do these blocking drills, and then you're yelling at me because I can't do it right. Well, yeah, because I can't physically do it. Something to be aware of and think about, I think, So.
Absolutely. Great stuff. I got to tell you, this is awesome. I think this is going to be a great episode. And I love hearing about what you guys are doing. Now, I want to ask you this about the Dodgers. We did a show on batting practice, and, I've done a lot of work in Japan, and in Japan many years ago, they've started, not throwing typical batting practice. They used, pitchers. Right. They mixed it up. And depending on, like you said, depending on what that actual player needed, they would make that adjustment. You guys have started implementing in a minor league system, not your typical batting practice. And what were the initial issues when you first started to do that program?
I think it's just the pushback of the difference. Like, wait, we're going to do what?
Yeah.
This looks different. This feels different. I'm failing. A lot of pushback from the players, a lot of pushback from coaches, old school coaches. Like, what are we doing this for? Because of what happens sometimes as coaches, if a practice looks ugly or our players are failing, a lot of times the coaches will take it personal. Like they're not doing their job well enough.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally it's like if a player performs well in practice, then the coach feels like he's doing something right. So when you start creating or bringing new ideas like to change practice settings and players start failing and it's not matching up to what was just done in the cage, a coach wants to push back because it's like, wait a second, we just had it right and now you're messing it up.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side, the player also is like, wait a second, this is not right. I'm supposed to be hammering balls in BP. So those were the initial pushback things from it. In terms of comparing us to the Japanese stuff, there's no way to simulate a game at bat without an actual pitcher from 60 feet, 6 inches mixing pitches.
Yep.
We're not quite there yet for a lot of reasons. I mean, from a legality standpoint to a logistics standpoint, there's just a lot of things to consider in our environment to roll out bullpen or BP type pitchers like that.
Mm-hmm.
But we have done the machines and different angles and all that, and that, so it's the same type of challenges that people perceive it as. That's the initial kickback,
sure.
Right? Like, going back to the history of where that player has been, they're used to in their high school settings or their private lesson settings, the hammering balls and feeling good during BP all the time, and then you switch it from them to shock to the system a little bit.
Absolutely. And you know, anytime you start to challenge the status quo a little bit, it takes time, and that's understandable. But it's great to see the changes coming. I think it's going to be great for the game. And what I love about it, Sean, is that, you know, you're leading the example for our younger players and coaches. You know, again, I'm going to harp on that. I believe, you know, teaching this needs to start at the younger level, so that way the progress is a little bit faster. And you guys are just setting the example. Now, you mentioned I actually brought it up. You mentioned some pitfalls. I want to finish it with some pitfalls that you ran into as a coach and also some pitfalls you see now with coaches in practice. And then at the end, we're going to open it up, because I know we've missed some things, something that you felt was extremely important to talk about that we did not. So let's talk a little bit about the pitfalls first.
Yeah, I think I kind of mentioned it before, this idea of perfect practice and this idea of rep after rep after rep is the best way to do it. I do think we fall into that the idea that, you know, this practice performance. And I think if we can just shift our mind, like, being perfect at practice only makes you a perfect practicer. And if we just practice like a machine, rep after rep after rep with this no thought process, no decision making, no action plan, that's called a robot, right? These predetermined set patterns, same goal, same task, that's nowhere near how the game's played. You know, there's no way to predetermine a swing. You're out. You know, like, the game is constantly about adjusting and adapting to the environment and to the task at hand, constantly changing, whether it's a ground ball read, whether it's a pitch selection read, whether it's a pitcher making a decision what pitch to throw. You know, scripted bullpens, I think, are dangerous because that's not how – you don't script out pitches in a game. It's random. So this idea that having this perfect practice design or perfect practice execution is a major pitfall because – that's just not how the game's played. It's just not how we got. How do we shift it to the interaction between the player and the environment and perceptual awareness and just gaining these perceptual experiences as a way to go? But the pitfall, like I said, is just, and I found that too. How can I make our players feel good and make it look good in our practice setting? Because if they do, then they think I'm smart and they think I'm good. And they go in the game and they fail. And it's like, well, then we go try to fix something else in practice again. And it's like we're spinning plates. This doesn't work. So I think that's a major pitfall, you know, with not only coaches, but I think all of us. We've all done it. Sometimes I still do. You know, I still say, oh, that was great practice. Like, well, what does that even mean? It's like sometimes a good practice is one that you failed more than you succeeded, but you learn the most from it. I think that's something to keep aware of. Like, is it more about – you know, that quality over quantity, is what's quality mean? Is 10 out of 10 quality, or is failing 100 times also quality? Because if you learn something from your failures, you're getting better. That's a nice fine line or balance to walk though too. So that's some ideas on some pitfalls to be aware of that we all fall into. And especially at the younger levels, it's okay to failure, especially at the young developmental levels. Like, you're not supposed to be good. You know, there's a line I heard before, a golfer was on a pro coach on the putting green with a student of his, and the student putted a ball and he missed and he slammed his golf club down. And the pro was like, you're not good enough to get that mad yet. It's actually offensive to me. You know, so I say to our players now, like, you're not good enough to get that mad. You haven't put enough time in. You're not an expert. You're not getting paid $100 million. To get that mad about not being that good yet. So something to keep in mind. And that I'm something I'm passionate about, and I make sure I remind myself that, and also our players, that just because you're perfect in practice doesn't mean you're a perfect player. All that means is that you've got really good at the drills you're doing.
Wow. I'll tell you what, well said, because I love that part, you know, where you fail more often, that's how you get better. And I remember Michael Jordan saying, you know, when he was younger, the reason he became such a great player, he relates it to all the failures he had when he was younger.
Right.
So I'm going to throw this loaded question at you before we end the show with our final part. The loaded question is this: you got a 10 to 12 year old team, travel team, or 13 year old team. You begin implementing these things in your practice right away. Yes or no?
Absolutely, I do. Because you got to keep the long term development picture in mind. If I'm running a 13 year old travel team, my goal is not to win it. My personal goal is less concerned about winning the tournament. That's important. Winning's important. But my long-term goal as a coach, regardless of level I'm coaching at, is to develop them to go play down the road for as long as they possibly can. So, and the game's the game. Whether it's a big league game or it's a five-year-old game or a 12-year-old game, the game is based on decisions. It's based on speed changes. It's based on foundational principles. It's based on stressors and consequences. That's what the game is. So for coaching a game or to perform in a game, we should be practicing in those type of environments. And again, those different practice designs are relative to the age level. There's no doubt. I'm not going to run and then completely challenge a 12-year-old like I challenged my first rounder who's 22 on the brink of going to the big leagues. It's a whole different challenge. Sure, you know what I mean? Sure. But there's a time and a place for it, and that's the art of coaching. The art of coaching is knowing when to push, when to pull, and why. And then being able to explain to the player why, what the long-term goal is, not so much about today's practice. So I don't care what age group I had. If I was handed a 10-year-old team, I'd explain to them right up front what we're trying to do, and we do it. And at that age, of course, I'd explain to the parents what we're doing.
That, that's important because they're gonna feedback. And that's another part. You know what? And you brought up a great point. I'll tell you why. Because on this show, we strongly believe, and as we travel around the world with the International Sports Group, ISG Baseball, to coach, you know, the train coaches, one of the things that we stress is, you know, to educate the parents also because, you know, we're in it together, parents, players, and coaches.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah, I'm speaking to I'm going to the Texas High School Baseball Coaches Association conference tomorrow. I'm actually presenting on all this stuff tomorrow to 2,500 high school coaches, and I have some major league examples. But the point there also is going to be, it doesn't matter developmental skill level. Like, it doesn't matter what level of baseball we're at. These concepts apply. Now, how you implement the design may change based on what your needs are. Now, the lower the levels, it might be heavier foundational principle type practice, more of a block practice for a younger age. Fine. And maybe it's once a week or, you know, for about 5 minutes or so a day, it's decision making and speed change. And then for me, it changes. But every element applies. It's just a matter of how much weight or how much time you put into each one for each practice, right? It's not about eliminating any. It's just where you weight the time. So, again, it goes back to the art of coaching, knowing your players, knowing your ages, knowing what that particular team or players need at their developmental stage. That's the key to this whole thing.
Well, I'll tell you what, Sean, you got me energized. I took a lot of notes. You got some great, great concepts. I think you're going to do a fantastic job in Texas. And I'm glad that you're approaching it also from the younger kids level, you know, because you'll have a lot of coaches there, I'm sure, that are travel coaches. And I think this word will really help resonate with a lot of coaches. Now, I know, you know, there's so much to this. You've got so much knowledge to give. Let's finish it off with something that, you know, I didn't bring up that you really wanted to talk about. Talk to our coaches, players, and parents around the world, and then we'll close it off.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff, right? There's a lot of concepts and a lot of ideas, and each player, if you just view the player as a puzzle or a team as a puzzle, and there's so many different pieces to it, right? Whether it's practice design and everything that goes into it is a piece. They got hormonal changes and they got social pressures and they got these mental things that the stresses of school and girlfriends, and there's so many pieces to this player, right? And every puzzle is different. And it's being cognizant of that and being aware of that and being patient with it, I think is one thing. Another thing, that there is no perfect practice design. There's no such thing as the appropriate practice. The most perfect practice design is one that is adaptable, that's flexible, that maybe you can shift gears in the middle if it's not going the right direction, that you're not totally tied to 100%. Because once we get too tied to a practice plan and it's not going right, you see this all the time, that turns into drop your gloves, start running, or forget practice, you guys aren't buying in. Being able to adjust and adapt to what's happening in that particular day, that's the perfect practice design. if it's a design where it's rigid and you can't go off, you can't change or pivot off it, that's probably not very good either. Because you never know what a kid or a player or a group of players is going to bring that day. You never know what they're feeling, their emotional states, their fatigue level. Are they eating? Are they resting? Are they hydrating well enough? So there's a lot of, like I said, a lot of pieces to this puzzle as an individual player and a team to be aware of. And just being okay with that and being aware of it. And then again, on the personal level as a coach, the awareness of where is your mindset? I think I posted something today, like, is it fair to push this fixed mindset on players who aren't buying in per se to what you're saying? Like, whose fault is that? Is it, maybe it's the coach's fault for not communicating things the right way. Are we aware of our own selves and our coaching strategies and our coaching philosophy and how we're projecting on our players? Whose motivations are we keeping in mind? A lot of times I think personal coach motivations to win or get to a certain level for themselves gets projected on their players and teams, and it doesn't go very well a lot of the time. So again, back to the awareness piece, but we're all, like I said, you said, we're all in this thing together, and it's hard. Like, this is not like, hey, follow these strategies, you're going to go dominate the world. Like, it is really hard. Being a good coach takes time. Putting together a practice plan takes time, effort, energy. It's hard. And it's not going to go perfect every day. Just like we say with our players, it may get ugly sometimes. It's going to get ugly for us as coaches, and that's okay. Just being okay with it not being perfect, I think we get a lot better across the board.
Well, folks, you know why the Los Angeles Dodgers grabbed Sean Larkin as their skilled development coordinator. Follow him on Twitter. He's got a lot of great stuff. S. Larkin, L-A-R-K-I-N, 04. Again, on Twitter, check him out. This has been an outstanding show. Sean, cannot thank you enough for your time. Keep doing what you're doing, spreading the good stuff. Hope to see you somewhere, and God bless you, man.
Peter, thank you for what you do, not only for people, you know, domestically, but across the world, greatly benefit from your work and your message and all the coaches you bring aboard. So thank you for everything you do and all your listeners out there trying to get better as well.
All right, folks, Sean Larkin, Los Angeles Dodgers, want to thank them. And I want to thank all our listeners for listening to the show. If you love the show, check us out on Twitter, on Stitcher or iTunes. Give us a rating. That helps the show get out. Forward all our information to other people who are in the game of baseball so they can get better. Thank you for following the show. Don't forget to email me at petercaliendo@att.net if you have any questions, if you have any comments. I will get back to you right away. Love to hear from our audience. So thanks for listening today. Special thanks to Brian Kroc, our producer with the Lineup Media Group. Check them out at lineupmediagroup.fm. They've got a lot of great podcasts. And again, special thanks again to Sean Larkin with the Los Angeles Dodgers. I am your host, Pete Caliendo, with Baseball Outside the Box. Have a great coaching day, and we will see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm. This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.